Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is Carriad Lloyd.
Hello.
Award-winning. Lloyd.
Yes, I did specify.
You have to say that, otherwise you don't come in.
Congratulations on
your...
You've got three podcast awards.
British podcast awards.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was very exciting. I didn't expect to have any. So that's quite nice. When you do a show about death, you don't think people are going to give you best entertainment.
So. It's such a good subject for a podcast, really.
Yeah, people say that, but it wasn't conscious. Do you know what I mean? Like, because a lot of people say to me, "Oh, good idea." Well, like, caught the fashion and the trend of death at the moment.
Is there a death trend at the moment?
Apparently,
no one used to die. Apparently,
yeah,
this is a new thing.
Exactly, it's brand new. Yeah, so I do a show called Griefcast, where I interview comedians about their experiences of grief and death. But it's only because my dad died when I was 15. So I've spent a long time talking about this. I literally thought, I always have these chats with comedians, really bleak, sort of bleak but melancholic and happy chats about death at like, you know, a gig or a party when everyone else is having a nice time. And I thought, I wonder if anyone else would want to hear that. Because it's just, like, sometimes I have a really intense chat and I think, oh, that's a shame that that's gone. Yeah. You know, we didn't get to sort of put that out. That's literally all I thought.
I think what's interesting about it, among many things, is that because you're talking to people who are in comedy, they've got a slightly different set of coping mechanisms, mm-hmm. haven't they? Because they are able
to find
the black humour in it, and they are able to find the levity in what is basically a shit situation. Really.
Yeah. I think if you're not in comedy, because I get a lot of emails from people being like, I'm not in comedy, but I made jokes about this. I think what it is that comedians don't feel so bad about reacting like that because they're used to their whole life, anything awkward, whether it's death or, you know, a party or being a teenager, they've made jokes about it. That's how they've coped. Mm. So when death came along or grief came along, they went, oh, I'm just going to do what I always do, which is crack jokes at inappropriate times because that's how I cope. But I think, inverted commas, normal people, the muggles, as Sarah Pascoe calls them. I think they sometimes feel guilty, like, oh, I shouldn't, you know, I'm only going to say that joke to my family about my dead dad, but obviously I'd never say it. Whereas I think comedians are like, no, that's how I survive life, is by making jokes at difficult moments.
But that's almost like the, if I was going to be forced with a gun to my head to sort of say, how does comedy work?
Yeah.
I think it is not going for the first standard reaction to something. It's taking a step right to the left and looking at it from a slightly different angle and seeing, okay, well, what if I didn't react that way? I reacted a different way. And you can apply that, shockingly, to everything, even down to death. And with death and with grief, there's such an expected way to behave.
Yeah.
And there's also a dignified way to,
necessarily people, there's a way you're supposed to give your condolences and send flowers and things. And the first people who are going to say, do you know what? What if I didn't send flowers? And then start thinking about it a different way. Probably writers and comedians who they do that in their job all the time. What if I thought about politics a different way or whatever?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. It's just that, and I think, it's helpful to have a set of rules of how to react about grief and death, but often we've got these like Victorian rules about stuff, but weirdly we've lost all of the Victorian sense of like ritual. So we've lost this idea of like someone wearing mourning or a black armband or being very respectful, but yet we've kept the repression and the I don't know what to say to you. So then you're left with like, well, there's no ritual to help me deal with this, but I don't know what to say to you, so I'm just not going to say anything. And I think that's really interesting that a comedian will then go, well, what if I just made a joke about your dad being dead or my dad being dead? And I don't come from a family of comedians and writers really at all, but my family dealt with it through humour. But my mum's side, my mum's from like sort of East End Essex, so there was just this very like, they don't really do sad very well, they do funny much better.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I grew up with, like if you don't laugh you cry. So that, and that's the worst thing that can happen is let's crack jokes, guys.
I've always said that if you talked about what the platonic ideal, the funniest joke in the world would be, and my phrase was always, the funniest joke you ever heard is a joke shared between siblings in the back row of a funeral.
Oh, God, yes.
And you're always so aiming. Funny. Everything you do is to aim to share a private joke with the public is the skill you learn as a comedian.
Yeah.
And the giggliest joke is you're not meant to be laughing. This person gets all the references.
Yeah, yeah.
You are friends. This is a tribal signifier between you. It's valuable. And you trying to hold the laugh in. And there are versions of that that are more diluted, like not laughing in a physics lesson. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about people who do live comedy is you're trying to make people laugh in an atmosphere where you're allowed to laugh.
Yeah.
And you tend to not laugh when you're allowed to laugh. You tend to laugh far deeper when you're not meant to be laughing.
That's so, like, he said one of his funniest moments is him and his sister crying at their grandma's, like, granny's funeral, because the way the pallbearers were walking was very Monty Python-esque. And they just, and they said they didn't even say anything. They both watched Monty Python. They both just knew. And he said he just knew that she was laughing about the same thing. They were both trying to hold it on and they were like just crying. And of course, everyone thought they were crying for their granny, but they were just crying at these slightly sort of tall, skinny pallbearers walking. And I think also the thing that people forget is the release, because you are extremely sad. So it's not like, death is funny. It isn't. Death is horribly tragic and sad, but sometimes you want to break from that. So the jokes become much funnier than they are at a comedy club, because you're currently grieving and you just want to breathe air again, and jokes allow you to breathe air. You're like, oh, there's life. That's what I used to feel. I used to feel happy. Oh, right, now I'm grieving again. But that joke becomes like this, like the coolest glass of water on the hottest day possible, because you're like, oh, yeah, I remember when I was happy. Oh, there, it's gone. But it's really nice to have that moment.
It's surfacing for air.
Oh, yeah, like, you can't breathe.
You're underwater and you come up and normality is there. And I suppose that's... Yeah.
And it's a I think that's why it is a coping mechanism, because it reminds you will get over, you know, not over it, but you will get past this particular painful moment. You will get back to normal life. You won't be this shell of a person. And the joke allows you sort of to, like time machine, to fast forward and be like, oh yeah, there's me happy. I'm not there yet, but I can be there for, you know, 10 seconds in a joke.
Yeah. It's the simplest thing possible to tell someone who's grieving, going, it's okay, in a few days this will not be how you feel.
Yeah.
In a few hours, in a few minutes. But when you're in the middle of it, it feels like it's going to stretch on forever. So a joke at that point to go, oh, remember when it was funny.
Remember your heart was... And literally, like, with all those phrases we use, like heartwarming, heart lifting, like your heart does lift when you laugh. And then you sort of go, oh yeah, my body won't feel this pain anymore. And that's why people say it gets easier with time. It's not that it gets easier, it's that you realise it will end.
Yeah.
So your first year is fucking awful. It's just awful because it's the first time you've ever gone through those things. But then the next time those waves of grief happen, you go, oh yeah, I got through that, didn't I? So maybe I'll get through this. So you just unfortunately have to have that first year where you learn, oh, there is light at the end of the tunnel.
People say that about having a second child, don't they? It's easier because you know,
they
didn't stay a baby. I wasn't awake for the whole of my life. It was only for a short period.
Yeah, I think birth and death obviously are so similar. I've just had a baby 18 months ago, and I can't believe how similar the first year of having a baby is to the first year of grief, because you feel exactly because you're not sleeping, so you're exhausted, which it's similar when you're grieving. You can't sleep properly. You're exhausted. Your emotions are all over the place. You feel isolated. No one understands your position. Like when someone's died, there's just an absence of someone. And when someone's born, there's just the presence. So it's a different feeling, but it's, I think, so, so similar.
Holy shit, that's a brilliant point. I've never thought that.
It reminded me so much.
It's adding or removing someone from your life. It either leaves a hole or occupies where there was a space. And you suddenly go, oh, I'm banging my elbow on that person who wasn't there. Or I reach out to grab them and they've gone.
And like when you have a baby and then suddenly like there is literally this like new circle in your life. You're like, oh, I can't move there anymore because there's a thing in the way. That's weird. And the same, like when someone's gone, you're like, oh, I can stretch my arm out. They're not there. Oh, they, you know, we get used to each other's presence and energy or souls, whatever you want to call it. So I think, yeah, birth and death are extremely similar. And now I can, having had a child, I can now understand that second child thing. Because when you have that first year of a baby, you're like, this, tell me this isn't going to be how it is forever. I remember saying that to people. Like, is it like this forever? And people kept going, no, you will sleep again, you will leave the house.
Sometimes that period will last like something like 2 days.
Yeah.
That a child will go through a period of behaving in a certain way and you go, is this the rest of my life? And then 2 days later, they've changed, they've stopped doing that thing. And you've forgotten you ever went through it because you're too tired to have those memories.
The rate of change of being a parent of a very young child is really weird because I remember having a conversation when our first child was about 6 months old. We had some friends who had a child that was about 2 months old and they asked us a question about something, whether it was colic or something like that. And we both went, I can't remember.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Don't know. Because because it's so long ago, because the child keeps changing and changing and changing and the routines keep changing.
It's
you
so
forget
fast.
All that stuff that used to happen and only a few months ago.
When you're the parent of the two-month-old, you're like, what do you mean you can't fucking remember? What is wrong with you?
What's it done to your brain?
Like, this is the most dominating thing in my life.
Yeah, then when you're suddenly the 6 months, you're like, oh, I don't know what we... Because I remember saying to my mum, like, oh, well, you know, how did you feel when, like, the first month? And she was like, oh, I can't really remember. And I thought, what? What kind of mother are you? What do you mean you don't remember? And then I got there and was like, oh, I see. It's really overwhelming.
We talked to Izzy Sutty about this and set up the very often when you get professional childcare or family childcare, you pull people in going, you'll know what to do. And the people you pull in are either 18-year-old girls who've never had children who babysit your kid or your mum or dad who will have forgotten everything.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
You get people. If you wanted to challenge me to do something right now, it wouldn't be to strip a rifle. It would be to make a bottle of formula milk. I simply couldn't do it. And I did that for years.
I know.
Sterilizing.
I know.
Oh,
I was thinking about that the other day because I found like one bit of the sterilizer and I was like, the sterilizer like, that we got rid of.
Artifact is this?
And I was like, God, that was like the biggest part of our life.
Such a routine, isn't
it? Yeah, and it's like, you know, but say with grief, like that first year you think, I will never feel happy again. I will never talk to my friends. I will never appreciate. Like,
it could be a betrayal almost to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And if you see anyone happy, you're like, what are you doing? Who are you? And then suddenly 2 years has gone by and you're smiling or you're watching a film. And you're like, oh, I see it, you know. And that's not to say, again, it's things like, if you have a child, no one would disagree with the statement, it changes your life forever. Mm. And if you lose someone, it changes your life forever. Like,
yeah,
it's not going to magically, oh, you're fine now. Like, no one would say, well, your child is 4, you're not a father anymore, and you've done it. They're up, they're at school. What is your problem? No one would say that to you. Apart from the very posh, you send it to a school, and then your job is done. But people would say to you 4 years after your parent or sibling or child has died, oh, well, you know, you've done it now. But why? They were a huge part of your life. They either created you or part of your family. Why would you magically never think about them again or be over it? You wouldn't say that about a child. So why would you say that about the loss of someone when they're, you know, they are the opposite ends of the scale, basically.
I mean, I think we're finding it less weird to talk about it now societally, aren't we?
Yeah.
But it is an odd thing.
It's definitely changing. I mean, I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, there's stuff that's talked about now on telly and in comedy that 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember I used to watch a lot of cartoons as a kid and like sort of like Tex Avery stuff. And there was always, Warner Brothers stuff, there was always a joke about the therapy. There was always cartoon therapist. There was a tiny man that would, you know, it was probably actually, now I think about it, horrifically anti-Semitic. Now I'm thinking about it. But he would always make them sit on a sofa, like, damn it, how you're feeling. And it would always be a joke that this person, and the idea of, you know, therapy in the 20th century was this very frightening thing that, what is this? What will happen? And now we're sort of at the end of that journey where it's like, yeah, you know, death is talked about, mental health is talked about way more. I know so much more about my friend's mental health than I ever did. did. My mum's always saying like, oh, everyone's bloody got anxiety now. Everyone's bloody got it. Because I was like, mum, yeah, I said, mum, I've got anxiety. She's like, well, I don't know anyone who hasn't got it. Well, how comes everybody's got it? And I was like, well, because I think we all had it. No one gave it a name.
As comedians were the first people who made me aware that it was okay to talk about mental health.
Yeah.
Because of... Well, certainly growing up, more problematic stuff. But Woody Allen was a huge thing.
I was just going to say, but the other so one for problematic. Me,
the
other but yeah,
Charles
totally...
Schultz, Peanuts.
Yeah, Peanuts where is Lucy, so bleak.
Lucy had her little therapist booth and she talked to her about and she was a shit therapist.
Yeah.
But he still was going for... Someone said that about Peanuts, said, what a genius idea that was to write a children's or a family comic strip about a child with long-term chronic depression.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. And I used to read Peanuts and go, that's how I feel. And I hadn't seen that represented anywhere else. And it was sadness. And
it, but
lost.
It was hidden. It like that's how you. It was always hidden, and like that's how you feel as a kid sometimes.
Totally.
But so that's made it safe. But it never was like that's how adults feel. I always felt it's like, oh yeah, it's hard being a kid sometimes, rather than it's hard being a human. Like he's lonely. Charlie Brown is lonely. Like some people are lonely.
He doesn't have friends.
Yeah, people are mean to him for no goddamn reason, and then he has to be friends with them again.
That's why there is. There's a thing here, isn't there? About it's possible to project, you know, 10, 15 years into the future and say there might be some comedies which we're eventually going to regard as unacceptable because what's happened is that the person has accidentally written someone with a mental health issue.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I mean,
a bit like if you look at Fawlty Towers and you go, okay, if people who have anger management issues, if that ever becomes a red hot fucking topic, that show will not be repeated, you know.
I think there's so many shows that, or like we said, this point we're hitting now, because, and I think it's totally century based. Like we're moving into the 21st century. So of course, 20th century things start looking really weird because it's the same as being, you know, imagine being in 1918 and looking back to like 1850, be like, what were those guys doing? Like, you know, it's the same. We are the Victorians of our generation because we lived in that bit.
Yeah.
You know, so I always get obsessed with that. Like, we're the end of a century, so we're always going to hark back to that century.
Well, obviously, we talked about death, and you brought onto Rule of Three the concept of death.
No. Oh, no, I tell you what, I'm going to go back to something you said about things that you discover at a certain age which come to mean so much to you.
Yes.
And to that, I have to say thank you for bringing this thing onto Rule of Three because I taped loads of these and watched them again and again and again, and I can still repeat vast chunks
We're
of the thing
about
that you
funerals.
Brought on. And you have brought on...
Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Probably the most dated title sequence of all time.
But I still think it captures the show in a really good way that a lot of title sequences don't these days. I get quite into title sequences. Some 90s things are awful, but I've got, well, obviously I've got softness for it. I love Whose Line Anyway. Yeah, so I was the same. I used to record Whose Line Anyway every Friday night on our VHS. And I think we used to also record Gladiators. So sometimes I wasn't allowed to stay up and watch that as well. So Saturday morning was just the best because me and my brother would get up and we'd watch Gladiators and then we'd watch Whose Line Is It Anyway, and I watched it obsessively. I think it was the first time I'd ever seen improv or impro. Yeah.
Which is it, by the way? That was one of my questions. Is it improv or impro?
So it's very political in the improvisation community. Yeah, it's really pathetically political.
Great.
I refuse to get involved. Basically, the father of UK improvisation is a man called Keith Johnston. He's at the Royal Court in the 60s, and all our impro came out of theatre games and the theatre workshop that he set up here, and then eventually he moved to Canada.
He used to call it theatre sports.
He invented theatre sports, which was like an amazing idea. He wanted to create an atmosphere like a football match or a boxing match, and people improvise against each other in teams, and there's judges, and trying to make that, because he really believed that if you could make it sporting, you know, more people would come to it, and you could root for your team. So he wrote this book called Impro. In America, you have Viola Spolin and Del Close, and they set up the Second City. Theirs comes much more from comedians and comedy and sketches, whereas ours is, it started at the Royal Court, so ours is much more theatrical. They called it improv. We called it impro. Anyway, so someone said it's an accent thing. If you think about it, English says you would say improvisation, so improvisation. So it'd be weird. You don't really say hit the V in the same way they do.
The V's the second half of the word in English. Yeah. And it's
so that's why we did impro. But now you get, honestly, it's so political. Like some people get really like... I call it improv now just because it's sort of fashionable. But then one of my like mentors in impro was like, how would you feel if everyone demanded you called it the sidewalk? Like, why? She's like, it's American. Why?
Well, I think you're coming from a comedy background as well. Yeah. So you can have the comedy bit of it, can't you?
It just became, like, when I started, it was impro, completely impro. Yeah. Then everyone just started calling it improv. And I was like, whatever, it's making stuff up. Like, who gives a shit? Like, I'll just call it, what's the easiest way to communicate what I'm doing? Yeah. If I say improv, I think people now go, oh yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, like it's making stuff up. And when we say people invented it, they didn't. No one invented making stuff up. It's been happening for thousands of years. So
it's a codified thing. I was reading up about Johnson last night. And the thing that occurred to me while I was reading it, which hadn't occurred to me about improv, it coming from a theatrical background, is that when he invents Keith would say improv.
Yeah,
you're in a period in Britain where your scripts have to be submitted to the Lord Chamberlain. There's censorship. So the easiest way of doing whatever the hell you like on stage around the time we're about to do Hair and things like that is to say we don't have a script.
Yeah,
and it's quite a revolutionary thing when theatre is so controlled by the government to say it's quite subversive to say, what are you going to do tonight? We don't know.
Yeah. It was very radical at the time. You know, the Royal Court was a like very radical place of exciting things. And, you know, some of those Whose Line style games, which is what we call short form impro. That's what Whose Line is short form. So there's, you know, it's little sketches as opposed to long form, which is what I do with Ostentatious or Showstopper. It's a longer narrative. You know, it was a bunch of actors at the Royal Court. And literally when you read his book, Impro, they would just try stuff out. And he would just be like, well, is it funny if you do this, or is it funny if you don't know who everyone is at the party? Yeah. Is that funny? And it was never about comedy for him. For Keith, it was always about freeing the actor, finding truth, like a really pure kind of theatrical experience. Mm. And then obviously, as it goes on, people go, oh, actually, if you make it party quirks and you do this and you make them, they have to be the prime minister, you can make this properly funny as opposed to some actors dicking around.
Yeah.
And some of it's just parlour games that I think existed anyway. I mean, it's a, you know.
That's what Whose Line basically was, wasn't it? It's a series of parlour games.
It's a total series of parlour games, but coming from the improvisation school of like some of those. So some of those games I think are just like questions only. Must just be a parlour game. I can't believe that wasn't around, like, only, you know, when you're only allowed to ask a question.
Yeah.
But then games like Genre Roller Coaster, or they call it film and theatre styles, like, that is, as far as I know, a short-form comedy game that was invented for the purpose, the medium of improvisation. Like, I don't know if you would have done that Victorian times.
No, that's almost like being in a band and being able to do cover versions of things.
Yeah, exactly.
You should be able to play in various styles. It's pastiche, isn't it? And it's keeping your muscles flexed if you're a comedian.
Yeah, yeah. And some improvisers are better than others, and some are better at the singing. And so, like, everyone has different skills they can bring to the short form table.
That's rather unlucky in Peckham, isn't it?
Okay, going to Hollywood Epic.
But the Peckham I speak of course, is not the Peckham of South London. The Peckham I speak of is the Peckham of my family, my forefathers.
No more, Claudius. You speak of you bends and pipes of which you know nothing.
Before you saw Whose Line, did you think about performing at all? Was this the first performance style that you'd seen that you went, oh, I want to do that?
My parents were very amazing. They took us to the theatre like from when I was like 4 years old. So I used to go to the theatre a lot. We watched a lot of comedy, but I honestly didn't know that comedy was a job. Even after watching Whose Line is it? That's another podcast. But like, I would watch Whose Line and it never occurred to me that I would be allowed to do that. I thought these were very special, talented people. And like, I was so, I just honestly felt grateful I was allowed to watch it. I was like, God, I'm just so glad I got to see that.
When I'm older, I want to be in this audience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted to be at the RSC. I wanted to be a serious, I thought what proper performing was. My brother was obsessed with comedy. I have such a good background knowledge of comedy, is through him, because he got me into Red Dwarf and Blackadder and Monty Python. But Whose Line was the first thing that I think he liked, but I loved. Like, that was my I think it was the first thing that was mine that I really was like, I want to record it. Whereas my brother was more like, yeah, sure, we'll watch it, but it wasn't Blackadder, which honestly he could, you know, recite every single episode for. But then it wasn't until I went to uni and we did an improv show there with Sarah Pascoe, my very good friend. I want to say best friend. Someone laughed at me the other day for saying that. They're like, what, you're 16?
Are we allowed to keep best friends?
Yeah, I was like, oh, is that funny? Anyway, my best friend, Sarah Pascoe, and I did a show at uni. And that's when I was like, oh, maybe I could do this. Maybe I could, because I knew it back to fucking front. They didn't have to teach me a single game. I was like, yeah, I know, and right. I've watched it so much, I know how to play them, I know what's better and what is good when Ryan does this or Colin does that. So that was the first time at uni that I was like, oh, maybe I
that's
would be
interesting, because we talked about this a lot, and obviously we're writers, and a lot of people we talk to on this podcast, you say, I watched this and I learned how to do it, because you learn by listening to LPs over and over again, or watching videotapes again and again. You learn the rhythms of it, whether you're an actor or a writer or whatever, the thing you like. And where do you think about Who's Line? And you go, well, it's not a script you can learn or anything. No. It's not got that Monty Python repeated thing. But weirdly, you'll learn how they're doing those tricks by watching them.
Because short form, like, to be fair, I love short form, but sometimes it is a series of tricks. And if you watch a lot of Who's Line, you know, you do see patterns emerge. But that's not to denigrate any of the improvisation. They are genuinely making it up. It's just, I think the thing people get confused with, it's not that there is a plan, but like, same as if you're writing a script, you know, okay, A plus B, that would be funny if it's C. Yeah. And the same with improv. Like, if you've said A and I've said B, well, I'm hoping you're going to say C because I know how comedy works.
You're passing a ball around.
Yeah,
it is theatre sports.
It is literally theatre sports.
You know how to get into space to receive the ball. I'm really good at sport metaphors. I'm amazing at them. I'm going to do them the whole time.
Well, we had to write to a friend of ours the other day and say, could you help us describe football, please? We were having trouble with it.
We had an amazing experience on, I think it was on Michelin Web, where John Dryden Taylor, who was on the writing team, had written a football sketch.
Wow.
And he wasn't on set, and everyone else was on set. So there were about, I imagine, 12 or 13 men on set, none of whom like sport, all trying to work out.
Of course, because you were doing a sketch show. Those are not the sports guys.
John's script said, David chips a confident ball into the box. And David went, and what would that be? They had to phone him. Chips? And he had to describe it over the phone too, because the director didn't know. No one knew.
There was a nice one in one of the early episodes of Who's Line where Stephen Fry, who I didn't realise was meant to be a full-time part of the thing, and Stephen Fry, who you don't think of as an improviser, do you?
No, I know, and there's lots of bit. Jonathan Pryce.
Jonathan Pryce is so great. There's a bit where he basically does a little Godot scene with, I can't remember who it's with now, is it with John Sessions?
Sessions will do you.
Sessions is in the early ones as well.
Jonathan Pryce almost does nothing.
Yeah.
He just moves and just nods and looks sad.
I never liked him as a kid, I have to say, because he didn't do that. Obviously, it's really, I think that's very subtle adult humour. As a kid, I was like, where's his funny face? Yeah. Why is he doing a voice? That man's rubbish.
Nothing to the party.
I was like, he's not funny. But now you see what he's doing is beautiful.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's a nice revealing thing in one of the, Stephen Fry is Arthur, they're playing World's Worst.
Now, this next game is called The World's Worst. Better come forward on the World's Worst step there. Ready to step forward with the world's worst thing to say when being introduced to a member of the royal family. So just as you think of them, I'll buzz when I've got the idea. World's worst person to be or thing to say.
Fry comes forward twice. And the first time he comes forward, he says,
what's some scud on that bit?
No, it's odd. In fact, I didn't say that. It's very odd. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And he's obviously reaching for something right over the other side of the taste barrier. But the second time he comes forward, he says,
That reminds me, I must buy a stamp.
And there's something so nice about going, when you're in this situation, you've got so many places you can reach to find the gag.
But it's almost like being in a writer's room, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like when you're in a writer's room and you're writing with someone and you can just keep, you know, that fun bit where you just keep suggesting punchlines until both of you hit a weird point where you're like, oh, that's not funny, but we found it funny.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with improv. You can just, especially with short form, you can just keep hammering stuff.
Hi, Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I always say this when people say to me, oh, I don't know, is improv relevant? I'm like, list any of your favourite American comedy film person. They all did improv.
Yeah. Like, Second City.
Second City, UCB, the IO. They have, you know, huge schools in New York. Chicago is the home, the big home of it. But there's schools in New York, Chicago, LA. Like every big city in America has an improv theatre. That's why in the American Office, you can make a joke about him going to improv classes, which I tell you what, killed me. Because he always gets the gun and shoot someone, like that is improvisers writing that is pure improv jokes that you have to have done classes to get, and they can put that on a quite big show because they know that people will know that reference. You wouldn't be able to do that here because ours comes from theatre, so it comes from a much more rarefied background, not as accessible to everyone. Theirs was much more like anyone can do it. You pitch up above a bar, you do a show. And that's it. And that's why you're now watching it going, oh, that reminds me of Bridesmaids or, you know, any of Will Ferrell's films.
Spinal Tap, for goodness sake.
Yeah, they're all improvisers.
That's your sort of beginning of the wellspring of what became American comedy. And obviously you went through to The Office and we sold them that loose performance style bat.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible.
That Christopher Guest and that gang had given us. It just occurred to me, it never occurred to me before, you said that World's Worst is a writer's room exercise. Those American writer's rooms, I imagine, are full of people who've done improv.
They all are. They all, like, I think you get, well, Tina Fey writes about it really good in Bossy Pants, and she writes about the writer's room for 30 Rock, where she was saying, like, you need a mix of, like, the sloppy improvisers and the, you know, Harvard Lampoon guys.
Yeah.
So you do get that balance and those references. But I often feel, you know, I do writing and I love doing it. I love writing on my own, but if we had a system of writers' rooms, I would enjoy my job so much more. Because I work better that way.
There are loads of British people who don't thrive in a writers' room. We really enjoy writers' room. Because in the writers' room, no one's looking. I can perform.
And
I will throw ideas out all the time. And I enjoy doing that. And I think they're always talking about saying, why can't we import the American writers' room system? And we've always said money is too expensive. But actually, I don't think we've got the experience. Everyone is used to sitting in an attic just typing in this country.
I think it's about... I think it's about credit. I think they come from this world where improv, the grand ethos of improv is if I look good, you look good. We're all in this together. My job is to make sure you guys do well. That's the job of an improviser. Whereas we come from, again, that theatrical background, the cult of the writer, the artist, the playwright. So I think we have a much more... A man goes off by himself, maybe two men go off by themselves and they write that, then they bring it back. And that's done. That's the process.
It's a Galton and Simpson.
Yeah,
the people who invented the comedy writing in this country were Associated London Scripts.
Yeah.
So it's Eric Sykes, Johnny Speight, Galton and Simpson, yeah. Eddie Braben. They go off and they bring the thing back and have a nervous breakdown trying to deliver 13 scripts
a year. Of course, because it's like, and when you talk to Americans about it, they're like, it's insane that one person does that. You know, like, how could one person do that? And then you watch sitcoms you love and you're like, yeah, episode 5 was a bit...
They're tired.
Yeah. But why? Like, I think I've been involved in people trying to get writers' rooms here, and every time it's come up is people have got very funny about credit. Well, how will I get paid properly for that? Is it my joke? Rather than having this much better, you all get paid the same because the product is what mattered. Because we come from, I write by myself, I get the money, I get the credit. And I don't think we've quite switched, which maybe we don't have to. Maybe that's an English way of doing it and that's brilliant and should be preserved. But it's frustrating for someone who I definitely feel like I work better in a way that isn't commonly here.
Right. That hadn't occurred to me at all, that improv would be key to how you could take the South Park writer's room full of people, take all those jokes and then go off, type it up, and it belonged to Parker and Stone.
Yeah.
Because everyone's there to make them look good.
Everyone's there to make them look good. And also, if you think about the thing about improv, it's super cheap, right? Anyone can do it. So you don't need to even film something, right? A bunch of teenagers can go to their local school hall after school and do a class and muck around with their friends and learn how to be funny. And that's what's happening especially in Canada, massive. They do it at school in Canada and all over America. So those teenagers, rather than like maybe go around to their mates and play football, they go out and do improv. So then they get really good at making up stuff on the spot. Whereas say if our teenagers into comedy, perhaps they go away and they write by themselves because that's what's available to them.
Or they learn a stand-up routine.
They learn stand-up, yeah. Like our stand-ups are, you know, that's the other thing I think is interesting when you compare. Like the Americans I met like are very intrigued by Edinburgh and that you have an hour and it's a story, which I love. I love an Edinburgh hour, but they don't really have that. They have your 5 for late night with Seth Meyers and your 20 for, you know, really tight sets that are not narrative. They're a series of jokes because they're good at just going gag, 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 gag. Whereas I think, again, we have this intrinsic want to tell a story, which is slightly different.
When you do long form like Ostentatious, is there a lot more preparation in it? Do you need to sort of roughly know the shape of what you're going to do before you get on stage?
No, it's a different skill. You have to just be able to hold a story together for longer. So if you think about like Whose Line, there's lots of, like when they do film and theatre styles, you know, they might get a mini story and that story lasts 2 minutes. So essentially, it's a sketch. It's sketch versus sitcom. So when you come to do Ostentatious, you're thinking in more sitcom or play, really. We do a comedy play.
Right.
So you're just trying to make sure you can hold a narrative in your head. And that comes, I would say, from doing it. Like, so all of us in that show have been doing it like 10 years, basically, improvising. Wow. We've been doing the show for 7. So we've got very good.
The novel we will be performing this evening
is Jane Austen's beautiful novel.
That's not Alan!
It is as if anything could happen. How would you advise me to grow into the man you wish I was?
Eat turnips!
Are you all right?
Yes.
Would you like a glass of water?
No.
Good. I wouldn't have got you one.
It's live writing is what people often compare it to.
Yeah.
So instead of being able to go, oh, I'm not sure what happens in the next act, we have to do it now and we have to fix our mistakes as we go. So rather than, you know, if you two are sitting down writing, you can be like, oh, I don't think she should have done that in act 3. She should have stayed. We have to, at the end of the interval, have to be like, oh, she's changed her mind. She's doing this because you suddenly realise, oh, actually, the story needs her to fall in love with him now, not, but she'd already said she loved him. Maybe we should, just let's have a sit. And that's, when I'm saying that, that's all that's happening in your head. We never communicate. We are genuinely improvising. But as a group, you have like a group sense of story. Yeah, it is.
You know the riffs and the chord sequences that you can use that when you lean back on each other.
It sounds incredibly stressful. It really does.
It's funny. I find writing much more stressful because I feel like there's a pressure of like, what you thought that was good. You actually took the time to write it down, print it out, and then show it to me. Whereas if I'm improvising, it's like, well, I'm improvising. So of course it's a bit rough and ready. Like I find writing way more pressured and stressful because I feel like the world is like, you actually took the time to do that.
You bothered. I was going to ask about this because one of the things that I associate Whose Line Is It Anyway with, this is going to sound insulting, but I don't mean it, because I remember thinking it even as a kid watching it, is the cringe. that there's sometimes they propose a game that you go, oh, this is going to be bad.
Yeah,
they're going to make John Sessions do a reggae song.
Oh, God.
Now, the next game is called Rap. It involves all four contestants. And what they have to do is simply to... It's a lovely game, this, isn't it, Stephen? Yeah. Stephen does this on his own anyway. In private, but in public, yeah, they all do four together, and they have to improvise a rap based on a subject selected now by the studio audience. So a nice broad topic for them to devise a rap around. You know what sort of rap music is, don't you?
And that cringe is so... You go, oh, don't fail. Oh, I can see all the ways you're going to fail. And then suddenly something unfurls out of it, even John Sessions doing reggae, that you go, that's so much better than I was expecting.
Yeah.
That the rush of endorphins, the relief...
Oh, my God, yeah.
I think I watched the first broadcast... Whose line? And it's Josie Lawrence and Richard Branch step into doing a Sondheim.
Oh, wow.
And they hit it and they both just effortlessly do a brilliant piece of Sondheim. And
the one where she's singing, Marry Me, Harry, Marry Me. Isn't that
all
one,
internal rhymes and loops and things. It's brilliant. Because she knows her Sondheim, it's an era she's comfortable in. He's really good at playing and is really good pastiche. But the two of them hit this thing. And I think the second before it happened, every bit of my body was tense.
Yeah.
What am I gonna do? When will Harry come and see me and marry me? Harry, marry me. Can you hear me sing, Harry? I just want you to ring, Harry. Oh, my telephone's lonely. No one will phone me.
And the relief, because of what you're saying, I think the expectations, weirdly, are very, very low.
Yeah.
Because the audience don't know how good everyone is.
Well, yeah, I think, especially when Whose Line must have come out on telly, is the first time you're seeing like improv like that. So it must have been like, well, there's no way anyone can do that, make up a song. And then you watch it and go, oh, yeah, they can. You know, and there's like, there was
it's
so
an
many...
Evel Knievel. You're watching the rocket cycle approach the edge of the cliff going, they're going to explode. And then they don't.
And
explode,
they don't.
Because they practice.
And that was episode one doing Sondheim. Yeah. I mean, that is a fucking high bar. Sondheim is not easy to pastiche. No. You
episode
know.
One is Sondheim and then into the John Sessions reggae, and we're all ready. I mean, to be honest, I was worried he'd get Dan Aykroyd's hat from Trading Places and put it on. He didn't.
Richard Branch never actually appeared as one of the four people on Whose Line, did he? Despite the fact he's an improviser of many years' experience.
So the slight political history, I should say, of Whose Line is that they were already doing the show. The Comedy Store Players existed before Whose Line.
Yeah.
So that's where it came from. So they were, you know, the original Comedy Store Players, who are too numerous to mention, but a lot of them, like Josie Lawrence and Paul Merton and Neil Mullarkey and Neil Ashton.
Steve Sweeney in that?
I think Jim Sweeney, Steve Frost, Steve Steen.
Andy Smart, people like that.
And there's bloody loads of them. So I will have forgotten someone. But they were doing it at the Comedy Store and they were rock stars. You know, it was starting to pack out every Wednesday and Sunday, and it's still going. I think they're into their 33rd year consistently doing this show.
You've done it, haven't you?
Yeah, I think they'd let me say I'm a regular guest.
Fantastic.
With them. Yeah, yeah. Because they've been going so long, it takes quite a while to become a regular. Do you know what I mean? Like, think you've done it for a year. They're like, yeah, so what? We've been doing it.
Are you the new guitarist in the Rolling Stones?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, myself, Pippa Evans, Ruth Bratt, David Reed, Lauren Shearing has done it as well. So we're sort of like, they're very kind, and they were like, we're getting old, we thought we better get some new people in. And then they're very sweet, because it's the only time in comedy I feel young, because obviously mostly when you do comedy or when you're gigging, everyone's like this fucking 19, 21 year olds, and you think, oh geez, like they're saying stuff and you're like, I got a mortgage and a baby, I cannot relate to what you're talking about right now. But in the Comedy Store Players dressing room, I'm on my phone on Instagram and they all say, oh, she's like a teenager, what are you doing, Carrie Ann? She's not listening to us. And I'm like, God, I feel so young. But yeah, they were already doing the show, and then that's kind of how Whose Line happened. As ever, it was a very successful show, and telly kind of went, whoa. But then obviously being telly, not all the Comedy Store Players ended up as main players.
So they get, I mean, it's on radio, it's Stephen Fry and John Sessions are the regulars.
Right, yeah.
And Stephen Fry says he can't come over and persuade Sessions to go over to the TV version. So the anchor there is Sessions. And then they put in Josie Lawrence and a couple of Comedy Store people and then go looking for Americans. I think it's almost like they're attempting to dilute it to stop it being the Comedy Store Players TV show.
I mean, yeah, perhaps. I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but perhaps. And but I know they, Richard,
it's
Richard
quite
is a
broad cast.
Yeah, and Richard is a great improviser, but he could do the music. So he was the one who could improvise some time on the piano.
He's a great musician.
He's a great
musician. Said they replaced him with three people for the American version of Who's Line. Could require three musicians to do the job that Richard Ranch could do on his own.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
So it's a very, like, I can imagine, I'm sure it must have been a difficult time.
Well, that happened to Archie Harm, was supposed to be for Saturday Night Live, I think.
Oh, really?
He's one of the guys who was up for the original lineup of SNL and didn't do it, wanted to do more theatre, and ended up being an improviser, and then ends up being the first, probably the first American who's on the British version of Who's Line.
Yeah.
Is he always Mike McShane first?
No, McShane's later. It's Archie Harm first.
Right.
Because there's a great bit in the very early episode where he's introduced by Clive Anderson, who goes, from Spinal Tap, because obviously Archie Harm plays a tiny bit part in Spinal Tap, and everyone in the audience, you can see, thinks it's Christopher Guest. And they think they've got this amazing booking who's going to outclass everybody. But yeah, he's great. I like the Americans being in.
I have to say, my favourite when of Who's Line era, because it did go for such a long time, is when you get the really nice balance of, you know, the Ryan Stiles, Colin Mochrie, with
great.
The Josie Lawrence and the Tony Slattery's and, you know, Steve Frost.
It's the mixture of improv and impro.
Yeah, it is. Very good. Yeah. I really, and I adored Ryan Stiles. Like, I just thought he was the funniest man that had ever existed.
He's great, isn't he?
And as a kid, obviously, we're talking about things you miss. Because he did such physical comedy, it was so easy to get. Whereas I knew, like, especially with Sessions, you'd be like, I don't know what that was a reference to.
I haven't read any Hemingway.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. But actually, I thought this. I think that I haven't read any Hemingway. But when I have to do pastiche Hemingway, I think I'm doing John Sessions.
He's
one of people like Monty Python that I learned about all these great authors by his pastiche. He went, right, it's lots of Spain.
He knew that the river came round in the middle of the course, which was a shame because it was a racehorse, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter a cuss. It didn't matter a damn, because he knew what his father had told him about. It was no cogida. No cogida for the horse or for him. The horse went along and then it went down a bit. And then it came up a bit. And then if you look at it from the other side, it went down a bit more. That is what we call in Spain, Arumia.
I think Sessions' pastiche has opened up a load of high culture to me that was completely
closed.
Yeah,
he's how I hear Shakespeare. He's that thing in the first series we were doing, Fate might I pair thee like a quince. And that's how Shakespeare sounds to me. Yeah. It's not, it's John Sessions.
It's a perfect impression. It's a bit like, do you remember when John Coleshaw used to do Tony Blair all the time? And then everybody's impression was John Coleshaw, not Tony Blair.
Someone unlocks it. Someone finds the key.
Exactly, find the key. And it was like, oh, well, that's... Let's just do that.
The other person who could do Shakespeare like that, with that rhythm, is Peter Cook. And they get Peter Cook on almost as someone who... Peter Cook, I always got the feeling, probably doesn't like writing things down.
No, it's too hard. You get that impression.
That's why you get Derek and Clive, and there's all the improv and the looseness that's in Pete and Dud. He's sort of the spiritual godfather of going up on stage not knowing what you're about to say. All those British comedians. And they get him on. And watching Peter Cook in that, and I only found out recently, he's absolutely pissed.
We'll be discussing the topic of smoking.
I'm terribly sorry I'm late, but I got delayed because I was smoking and my burr caught fire.
Your burr caught fire, yeah. That does illustrate one of the dangers of smoking, and indeed
and
one of the dangers...
And one of the perils of boas.
Boas, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Apparently, the 4 o'clock run-through, he was the most astonishingly astute, sharp mind. They went, God, he's not lost a bit. And then Rory McGrath took him out for a couple of points to steady his nerves.
Oh, jeez.
And he comes back.
But he's
great,
very good in it, though.
But he doesn't know what he's doing. You can hear him slurring. He can't get the words in order.
Could I ask you your name? Could I ask your name? Could I ask
yes,
your
of
name?
Course you can. Yes.
Well, I'll do that now. What is your name?
Yes, Arthur.
Yes, sir, Arthur.
Yes, sir, Arthur.
Yes, sir, you're an Arab gentleman, are you?
What?
An Arab gentleman, are you?
No, I'm a married gentleman.
A married gentleman.
Yes, if you want me to be Arab, I, of course, will, you know.
Yes.
No, this is just a religious thing I wear.
Yeah. And I'll just talk to somebody else who might talk English better than you do.
Mm-hmm. I didn't love it when it was all English people. I don't know. I think I really loved when, like, McShane and Proops and, Ryan and Colin. Like,
Proops is brilliant, isn't
he? He's amazing. And that's not to denigrate the English people. I just loved it when you got that mix, because I found it when those earlier series, when it was, and I don't mean to say it, but when it was four very sort of cerebral men, I was like, ugh, you know?
It's just
okay,
a game.
Well, you get... They sort of joke about British improv. It's like two white men facing each other, not moving their arms. Like,
like, which I've heard a lot before. And like, so, you know, when Josie's there and she's singing, and it's just that different energy. And that's what I felt. Ryan and Colin, they brought this energy that, for me, especially as a teenager, I was like, oh, you don't have to reference Hemingway for it to be funny.
Yes.
Even though I know, I'd always feel like, yeah, I get it. I know what you're doing. But when, you know, Ryan and Colin would just be the silliness that I just, and I felt like it popped the pomposity of what that show sometimes had.
It could be. It did look like. It's weird. You're talking about it.
It becomes a call my bluff almost, in a lineage of panel games. Yeah.
John Sessions' attitude would have suited like a 1970s or 60s panel game.
Perfect.
Like My Music or something.
Yes.
Or There's a certain sort of fruity dissembling Donald Sinden-ness
to
him.
And there's a certain, oh, very good.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I
polite
see.
Polite round of applause.
Witty pastiche. Wrong with that. Yeah.
That's what we're asking for.
I love Just a Minute as much as anyone else, but like, That energy that the Americans and Canadians brought, I think, really shook it up and made it go somewhere. Just gave it this real, and I think it made the British people funnier because they had to be on their toes. They couldn't sit back and go, you know what, I'm just going to throw out a fucking Shakespeare reference and that's, I'll get a round of applause.
It made them raise their game.
And I love watching people being pushed to their.
That's the kids at the back of the funeral, isn't it? Because the stakes are so fucking high that if I make you laugh now, I'm going to burst something.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually going to do some damage.
I love that. Right, what I thought they bought was a gentle energy as well.
Yeah.
So, like, I think sometimes with English, and I have this as well, English humour can be so sharp. It's brittle and edgy, isn't it? We really know how to say a joke and destroy someone at the same time. And I feel like the Americans were able to, and the Canadians, to be fair, because they are equally brilliant improvisers, was bring this, like, a silliness, a gentleness.
And welcome to Bunk Copy, the show where we dig beneath the news for the tepid dirt underneath. Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. That's the story here today. Kids, water, it's tragic and it happens. We have with us the next one. Dr. Omar Hamster Cheeks. Doctor?
Hello.
The only improv rule that I know is the don't say no one, which, to be honest...
Which
I think applies... Weirdly, we just talked about it for the first time, applies in writers' rooms as well.
I hate
lots of yes in writers' rooms, please. As Robert Webb once said, you're hosting a party, don't be a dick. and I think there's lots of that in there. The weird thing is that there are a couple of the British guys whose job is to say no. Paul Merton says no.
Yeah.
And what it's good, it's very, very funny because it breaks the rules of improv. But weirdly, he ends up commanding the stage because he's gone, that isn't happening. You're not really a werewolf. And part of me went, oh, and I bristle.
Yeah.
He's doing sort of bad improv.
Yeah.
He's allowed to be the no guy.
When I used to teach improv, I used to say, when you do level one, when you're teaching, you know, like the babies, you're like, never say no. It's always yes and, yes and. And then level two, they're like, what, can we never say no? And you're like, you have to get your no license.
Yeah.
So it's like, you have to be able to say no in a way that's helpful. And Paul, if you watch him, you're right. Like, if you were being very technical, you'd be like, oh, well, you said no and you said you're not this. But if you look, it always helps the scene.
It's no and.
So yeah, it's no and. And but it can, I mean, this is so, improv is so technical, like it's writing. So when
You've
I'm watching
him- come to the
him,
right place, you're
yeah,
in a safe
I
space
know.
Here. Get really nerdy, you want phrases,
okay.
terms.
When he's doing it, you can see it's taking the scene where the scene needs to go. So sometimes people, like, we call it going to crazy town. So it's like, oh, you know, it's just something that's so big and so huge, the scene can't breathe. There can't be anything else but this person being a werewolf on acid meeting the queen. Like, that's too much. So if someone then knows it, I would say no and say, because I know what I'm doing. Like, I know that I'm not saying, fuck off, get off the stage, because that's what a beginner no is.
Yeah.
I'm saying no to this door, but can you come through this door with me?
Yeah.
Because this door is actually going to help us get to the end of the scene.
No and.
Yeah.
It's, weirdly, I always said that was go back to the writer's room, which I know better. The really amazing writers' rooms I've ever been in have been run by people who do that, who say, come to this door instead. And there's a really gentle and pleasant way of saying, the joke you've just done is no earthly use to this room.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you thought about this joke and still make the person think it was theirs? They would be impossible without the two of you. And it's an incredibly delicate collaborative process. And I think that writing in collaboration has loads in common with improv.
Oh, so similar. I think it's so similar because it's that idea of yes and. Like I said, it's live writing. So the idea is just like, we do this game, it's called like gift giving, and someone mimes an object and then that you have to act like it's the best thing. So you're like, oh my God, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I can't believe you got me a cat. And then it's the other person's job who had mimed the object to be like, yes, and the cat is also a fortune teller. So you've made something together, but you start establishing what it's called an offer in the scene, so that's the offer. You start realizing that offers are gifts. So rather than me being like, oh, have you thought about the joke being like this, and you being like, that's an interruption, that's not what I want, it's unhelpful, you start seeing that as, oh, thank you, I hadn't. So just by changing that in improv, you have a scene that's pleasant to watch, that goes somewhere, that go, the story moves forward.
Mm.
And it's the same in writing, right? If someone if one character's like, no, I don't
and
want
I,
that.
I, and I claim ownership of this joke, and if you change it,
the
it's
scene
not
doesn't
mine anymore.
Go anywhere. The scene just literally stops. Whereas by treating it as a gift, like, oh, thank you so much for this setup of a punchline, here's the punchline, like, it just, it's nicer to watch. I mean, it's funny as well, because, like, Whose Line is a big... Well, actually, Clive doesn't. Clive rejects some suggestions, and there used to be a thing in improv of, like, never say no to any suggestion. And now I'm like, I say no to suggestions, because I'm now skilled enough to know that won't help me.
Yeah. Well, you've done
proctologist
it before.
Won't help me. Prostitute won't help me. You know, the things that people in comedy clubs think are funny.
Yeah.
And a good gauge of a good offer from an audience, if it gets a laugh, the scene won't be funny, because the joke's already happened.
Ah.
So with Ostentatious, we get suggestions for a title. So sometimes, not always, but if something's a very funny title and the joke's already in there, then it's like, we don't need to do that show. Like, it's
the where the Onion headline, where all the jokes are in the headline.
Yeah, yeah. And then you don't need to read the article, right? Because it's done. So, like, to be fair, I think we did this one, but, like, Mansfield Jurassic Park. It's like a great title, right? But in a way, you're like, do I need to see that to know what's going to happen? Like,
the fun's in imagining
it. The fun's in imagining
it. The fun's in
it
not existing.
Mm. Whereas, like, you know, I remember that one of the best shows we have ever had was called, with the title we got was Sly's New Car. So boring, right? What the fuck? It was so good because it was just, there was no expectation about it. But then, you know, the other day we did Queer Eye for a Regency Guy, which... Again, it's not, so you're not laughing, but
no,
you're going,
the whole story's not there.
But you're like, oh, I can see what's going to happen. And then it was a great show. Yeah, yeah. So you're like, oh, that's going to be a fun show. But the ones, and again, those offers that make people laugh instantly, you know, brothel. And it's always sexual as well, because people are just like.
There must be a danger in that the audience are going to try and be funny.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's sort of, that's not necessarily helpful, is it?
Yeah. And I, having said, as I, you know, do the Comedy Store Players still, those guys are incredible. I'd say they're the best in the business of dismissing shit offers in a very graceful way, because they've been doing it for 33 years. So they just have all these, like, wonderful, like, you know, oh, you're in the wrong basement in Soho, sir, like, that's not very helpful, like, it's up to us to be funny. But they do it like no one's offended. It's, I watch it with fascination, because I'm like, you've told them to shut the fuck up, but no one minded.
Wow.
Like really good teachers, like really good, a teacher that's able to control a room, and, you know, or good stand-ups. It's difficult as well with improv, because it's changed now. So short form, the big thing with short form is, like, you'd have all these offers and that proves it's improvised. Like, look, they kind of made it up. They didn't know that we were going to get Sondheim. We didn't know. And then long form, what's happening now is, like, there's much less need to get the offers from the audience. So with Ostentatious, we get one title at the beginning. That's it. And that's very popular in America as well. They tend to get one word from the audience. That's it. So
do people suspect then that you've prepared it more?
So I don't think they do, but what happens is, I guess it's like when stand-up or writing moves on. So, like, if it's your first time to a show, you're like, oh, they didn't ask me, maybe they didn't make up. But, like, once you've watched it more than once, you're like, oh, they're still improvising.
Because things go wrong, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Things go wrong, and you can see people's faces are like, what the fuck did you just say?
That's what the joke is.
But there's definitely, when I speak to the generation above me in improv, there's, like, a nervousness about it, of like, well, how will the audience know? Because they come from that Whose Line world of, like, audience have to give every suggestion that proves we're making up. And I would say the younger generation now is like, fuck it, if you don't believe it's made up, I can't convince you.
It just is.
Clive Anderson is a strange choice of host, isn't he? He really is.
But I've actually done live Whose Line in Edinburgh.
Have you?
With Clive and Greg and, like, yeah, which never with Ryan or Colin, but with Greg was pretty cool, and McShane and Josie. And he's so good at that role, but it is an odd choice, isn't it? And I know they think I heard a documentary saying, where they were saying everyone was a bit surprised at the time, I think, because he was...
Well, he'd done it on the
so
radio.
Nervous.
You see the pilot, he's sweating.
And his
hands are... either he's shaking his hands, or he's doing that thing called stimming, where you can't keep your hands still, because you're fidgeting with, invisible objects.
Well, also, it must have been difficult, because the Comedy Store Players, the show that, you know, it was very much based on, they didn't have a host. They just introduced the games themselves. So this is a very TV idea, I guess. So there must have been a nervousness at the beginning, like, is this going to work with this man who's a lawyer?
Yeah.
But it's also quite funny.
This show needs is a barrister. Yeah. Give me a barrister.
But I loved Clive. And I have to say, one of the other things I loved about Whose Line was the ongoing feud with Greg, with Proops and Clive. I used to adore that. I adored how rude they were to each other when Greg would walk up to the camera and be like, Clive's not funny and I hate him, by the way. Let's do the scene. Okay, start. And then Clive would just be laughing. And they're like that with each other. I did a show with both of them. They still kind of like give each other shit, but in a very loving, we've worked together for a very long time.
It's like adding a soap opera on top of it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I'm obsessed with relationships and what's happening. And I love that Josie and McShane loved each other. Like you could see when they got up.
Oh man.
They would just hold hands. They just hold hands even they don't need to hold hands. And you'd feel the love. And McShane is the most loving improviser I've ever worked with. Like that man makes everybody look good.
That right from the off. Yeah. He arrives in the middle of the first series, I think, and he is so generous.
Yeah,
he
is incredible. And him and Greg like have known each other since college.
Wow.
So they've like known each other years and years and years. So they have like a very comfortable relationship.
All credits sort of Patterson and Leveson.
They
cast this.
Oh, the casting's amazing.
It's a moving cast.
Yeah.
They're really good at pairing people off and finding relationships and sticking at relationships, breaking up, trying new ones, pulling in people from different styles, from LA and from New York and from Chicago. Dropping them in with the British people and finding these little teams of people, or pairing people like Colin Mochrie and Ryan Stiles who'd work together, so you know that they won't be nervous. And then it's really well. Slattery, the discovery of
Slattery. We've got to him.
They discover Tony. They discover Tony Slattery because Stephen Fry says no, and Stephen Fry's agent represents Tony Slattery and says, "I've got a guy who's a bit sort of from the same kind."
Yeah.
And they go, "I'm not sure about this guy." And he turns up, and he is effortlessly, slickly, charming, funny, weird, beautiful.
I fancied him so much. I thought he was the strangest creature. Like, I was like, who is this person? He was so beautiful. But also, Slattery breaks every rule. He laughs all the time. He's always out of character. He's always talking to the audience. He argues with Clive and he's constantly... But again, it's such a naughty schoolboy. Like, I just think his energy is incredible.
Naughty is the word.
Yeah,
that's
he's
what
so
he is.
Naughty.
He's very naughty.
Yeah, very puckish, very naughty, cheeky. And again, I would say a very British energy that the Americans don't quite get, because he has a real glint in his eye that I feel like he's the only one who has of like, yeah, we all know this is a very silly thing we're all doing, but aren't I doing it very well? Like, I fancied him. I mean, a lot of my crushes were Whose Line.
I think everybody fancied him.
Yeah, he was so glad. And he looked very cool at the time, didn't he? Like, very fashionable for that era. There's some great... I mean, if you want to check out some great 90s looks, just watch one episode of it. It is incredible.
And the audience. There's some terrific glasses in the audience.
The giant jackets.
Everyone looks like David Byrne.
Oh, my God.
I mean, he does. I mean, he just... Big suits.
And the colours, that really kind of like muted purples and greens that are only... You could only buy clothes like that in the 90s. Like, and actually now, because it's come back round. But yeah, there's some incredible... Josie's still got some of the outfits. She gave some to me and Pippa. And Pippa got... like one of her Whose Line outfits that have to play it cool because I'm in a show with Josie now called Glenda J Collective, which is me, Pippa Evans and Ruth Batt from Showstopper and Josie Lawrence as an all female.
Wow.
And we just dick about, really. It's not really a format at all. But sometimes she says stuff about Whose Line and we all have to pretend that we're not like the biggest geek fans ever. So she was like, oh, I've got this Whose Line outfit. And Pippa and I knew what episode it was from. Like, we recognise it straight away.
It's like the Fred and Saunders sketch where they're trying on all the newsreaders' outfits. That's a Lee Ming. That's 84.
And it was just like, and she gave me a shirt that she wore on Whose Line. And I was just like, this is gold dust to me, you know. Because again, we talk about, you know, the great British ones. The Slattery is amazing. But Josie, you know, there was other women on it. But to have a woman on that show.
It was her and Sandy Toksvig were the two sort of featured women.
Oh. And then Caroline Quentin came along later. Yeah. She has such a cheekiness, I think, a playfulness, but also real heart that I think you sometimes, when the men are being very cerebral, she brings such emotion to the scenes. Like, you care about the people she plays in those scenes. Like, you want her to be okay in the bar or for like the hands through lady to make it. You really care about Josie in a way that you don't often care about some of the others.
There's a scene that she does where she's having to basically play sort of the female character from Brief Encounter taking a phone call. And she's talking, you know, in that lovely voice that they do, and her bottom lip starts quivering and it's a genuinely brilliant bit of acting. It's fantastic.
I saw one I was watching the other day. It was just her and Ryan doing Film and Theatre Styles, and Ryan's a real like, he'll yes and everything. That's why he'll just, whatever you do, he goes with it. So they get the suggestion, they're doing like a sci-fi, and then they get
you know, something really stupid Western, then they have to go into a weepy. And Josie plays it like a weepy. And then Ryan does too. And it becomes this, like, it's very silly. And they're sort of, oh, darling, don't die. Don't leave me. I couldn't bear it. But you really care. You start thinking, God, I hope they're all right. And you're like...
Okay, some sort of weepy, a rather sad, you know...
Oh, darling, don't die on me. You're my very life, my very soul. If you don't...
I could never leave you. Leave you alone with the children.
I'd be jealous of the angels up in heaven if you were to go.
I will stay with you here forever.
That's a huge thing when you teach improv, of like, gags are fine, and you must have this for writing, gags are fine, but ultimately if they care and you've made a gag, that's the ultimate goal. And with Ostentatious, that's always what we've wanted them. We wanted you to laugh throughout the whole show, but we want you at the end to give a shit if they get married or not.
Yes.
Like that's when we go, oh, it was a good show. We had an equal balance of emotion and funny.
Because there'll be a point where people are tired of laughing.
Yes.
Or you
yes.
This. We got asked to gag up a script recently, and I just phoned back nicely and politely said, you can't gag up a script. If we put more jokes on top of this, they'll just lay on the top.
Yeah.
And you won't be able to see it. What we need to do is take the script apart as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Work out why people don't care. The reason not laughing is because not because there's not enough jokes, is you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
You will either lack clarity or heart are the two things you're missing.
And that's the difference between short form and long form. Because short form, it's such a quick scene. So the weepy, do I care about Josie and Ryan? Oh, okay, fine, something else is happening.
Yeah.
But long form, I'm staying with those characters. Yeah. It does become a film or a play. And I think that's what, the more improv you do, the more writing you do, you start realising they'll laugh more if they care more. Whereas at the beginning, you're like, oh, I'm just going to chuck in the old gag. And we call it like killing the scene. There's gags that just, it's funny, but then the scene doesn't exist anymore because I've destroyed everything we've built up. So you're like, yes. And when you're teaching, people are like, yeah, but look how much everyone laughed. And you're like, yes, but can this scene carry on? And they're like, yeah, she could still be my girlfriend. I'm like, no, because the way you spoke to her means she's not your girlfriend. It means I don't believe you.
That's an amazing thing.
I don't believe you.
I think there's a lot of, especially, God, you hear things occasionally. I did, when they put the advert out, I got really cross. But Peter Kay's car share, entirely improvised. I went, oh, good. We've got rid of the writing now.
Because apparently
we don't need that anymore. I'm really cross about it. And actually, this has been fascinating talking about this, because I think there's so much crossover between improvisation and good, adept, fast, quick, collaborative writing, that actually they are the same thing. And you find this if you're writing a script. You'll have put a joke in, like that killing your darlings thing, that makes you piss yourself laughing. And it's the first thing you realised on draft four, you go, that is absolutely holding this below the waterline, because I need to care about these characters more than I need to laugh at that point, which is heresy as a comedy writer.
Yeah,
but it's true.
But then I think they will laugh more. And I know this because I improvise. So I hear a very immediate laugh to what's happening in the story. So that's how I've learned. They laugh more and deeper when they care more. The laugh is different. It's a quicker, when it's a quick gag that's destroyed the scene, it's a real burst. It's like, huh, and it's gone. And you feel like energy's gone, everything's gone, and this scene needs to just end. We can't get it back. But when it's about relationships and characters and story, it's a softer laugh, but it carries the scene forward, which carries the show
forward.
But
it's not drama. That's what I think people get mixed up with. Something like, I'm trying to think of a really, a Detectorist, it's actually dynamite, unarguable comedy that is very gentle and gag light. It's not full of lines and quick ones. But all the way through, you care.
And it's full of relationships.
And the people love it. But I would say that it's miles from drama. People often talk about it the wrong way, and they go, well, it's a sort of comedy drama. And no, it's not. It's a comedy. It's completely a comedy. There's nothing about the values of it that belongs to the world of drama. Everything about it is gentle and warm.
Yeah.
And you feel different watching it than you do watching Broadchurch. This is what comedy is.
Yeah.
Comedy is, there's loads of heart and relationship in comedy.
Yeah.
Even at the stage of going, we're making up with Jane Austen off the top of our heads, you've still got to care.
Of course, you massively have to care. I mean, Jane Austen, like, the whole point, you care. You want Darcy and Lizzie to get together. And there's some hilarious stuff in Jane Austen, but you still want to get together. And I understand, this is the problem, I think, maybe in this country, maybe I'm being unfair, but in this country sometimes when they're like, we're going to improv everything, and that pisses off the writers. But let me tell you, it pisses off the improvisers, because one, they don't usually get improvisers in to do it. They get people like, you know, comedians
actors
who aren't be hilariously funny, but aren't skilled in improv. Because improv in this country is not taken as seriously in comedy. And I get a amount of things I get asked, like, oh, just come in and improvise. And I'm like, Who's doing it? What's the purpose of it? Because things can be funny improvised that when you film them won't be funny written down. Like, improv jokes are completely different structure to written jokes. Like, there's all these crossovers, but obviously there's all these other separate bits. You can't, people just use improv as cheap instant television sometimes.
Right, like, so what happens then?
Yes.
When you do Murder and Successful, and you've got the mark in there, the person who's the guest that week, who is not at all involved with improv, how do you work with someone who doesn't know any of the rules? So, do you have to go over them or what?
No, so Murder and Successful is a really interesting hybrid, and I think definitely a follow-on from Whose Line, because, you know, there's no Whose Line on telly now. Everyone's like, oh, you can't do improv on telly. But Murder and Successful essentially is parlor games hidden around characters.
Yeah.
So the things that they do in Murder and Successful, first of all, there's a script. There's 100% a script.
Yeah.
Not everyone sticks to it.
No, we know.
Yeah, yes.
They don't stick to it for very good reasons and with very good results.
Yeah, and this, but the script is really important because you want there to be this loose murder plot. You want to know, I'm speaking to them first, da-da-da-da. So when I get, like, and I'll be honest, some people Murder Successful do stick to the script because that's their skill. They're coming in as impressionists or they're coming in as comedy performers.
Yeah.
But when they use me, they know I'm not going to stick to the script because that's what they've got me in for. So, you know, but there is a script. And also, if you have a guest who's just not playing, then I have a script to fall back on. But what I also think is fascinating about the time that Murder Successful has been made is that it uses quite a few reality TV stars, and I did not realise till I started working with them that they are improvisers. They are the current improv on television. What's improv on television?
Of course they are,
Love Island is improv on television.
Yep.
They are told what to say in that kind of, like, there's a loose script. There's a producer, Clive Anderson. There's a Clive Anderson in Love Island being like, Wes, you know what you should do? You should tell EL that they said that because it's out of order, isn't it? And instead of Colin Mochrie being like, oh, do you want me to do it in the style of a film noir? I can. There's a man who can't do it in the style of a film noir, but can go over and make it look real. So when we worked with Jamie Lang was the one that really stuck out with me because that's a lot of people's favourite episode. It's very, very funny. I couldn't believe how good he was. Like, I was like, he's improvising. Like, he's yes-anding everything I'm saying. He's not blocking me. He's building on stuff. He's calling back. And I was sat there going, of course, you're a fucking improviser. But reality TV has created improvisers, but I wouldn't, they probably don't class themselves that, they probably don't realise that they are, what's the word, unconsciously yes-anding, because they realise like, oh, if I have a scene, if I'm told to argue with Binky or whatever and I just say no, that doesn't get into the show, does it? But if I yes-and it and we discuss it, that becomes an interesting scene.
I so wasn't expecting this to end up at Love Island.
I suppose the thing that's really exciting about this is you're talking about collaboration.
Yeah.
Which is something, again, when you talk to people in comedy, you're either someone who won't collaborate.
Yes.
And you've got to be really talented to say, I will take no one else's advice. But most people are put in a position where you're relying on the people around you to make you look good. One person does it wrong.
Mm.
Something that was funny on the page is not funny. And I suppose the thing you get with improvisers is everyone is amazing at collaboration.
Yeah, completely strengthens your collaboration, and that's the reason I would like a writer's room, is because I come from improv, so I'm used to working with other people now, and I used to do a lot of theatre devising shows as well, comedy shows. I love working with other people. I love other people's ideas, because I just think I've never ever in my career seen an idea not be bettered by someone else's idea. So, like, when you realise that, when you're like, oh, here's my idea, I quite like it, but when I added someone else, it was so much more interesting. Why wouldn't you always want to collaborate?
Yeah.
What most improvisers are looking for, the hit we're all after, is the moment when neither of us know where it's going. And that is that's the best. When you're like, I don't know, and you see their eyes and they're like, I don't know.
Oh,
and
that's fantastic.
Can the audience see that as well?
Yeah, I think that's when you feel, you know, especially if you look, really good games from Whose Line, like a really good show is when you see it, their fate. We call it, like, Keith Johnson talks about, like, there's a light in that person.
Yeah.
And it's like they're on fire. There's a white in their eyes that you're like, that person seems to be glowing. What's happening? And it's like they genuinely don't know.
Isn't that how Tony Slattery looks all the time?
Yes,
though?
I think so.
Maybe that's the secret to this. What you're watching is something you very rarely get to see in comedy, which is the moment of inspiration.
Yeah.
Normally that's process. Hidden away somewhere else, and people sort of go, oh, I wish I could be on the fly on the wall of X or Y writer when they made up that. And you go, well, with improv, you get to watch that happen. And there's
Peter,
nothing
Peter Sellers
exciting.
Says that, doesn't he? Peter Sellers said in a Parkinson interview, he said the only bit of it that's enjoyable is the moment when it comes out of you.
Yeah.
That's why I get Blake to keep all those outtakes. because you can see the moment when you look at
and
those.
And what I love about improvisation is that if I'm improvising with someone, I get to see it, the audience get to see it, and then the audience get to see me seeing it.
Yeah.
So they see me trying not to laugh. They see me thinking, oh my God, he's not the great gameskeeper. He's my gameskeeper. He's not the groundskeeper. He's my dad. Like, and we all do the same thing at the same time. And then the reaction. So you, as an actor, obviously, when you're saying scripted lines, you're like, oh, here comes the bit they're going to realise. I get to feel it exactly the same moment the audience do. That is so fucking exciting. And then when you, especially with story, when like someone gets together or something's revealed and the audience go, oh, and all of us in ostentatious at the side go, oh, like, I didn't know Daniel was her dad. Like, what? And you realise they're just improvising. They
this
just made
amazing.
A choice. And I'm privileged to it.
What you've got there is something that's bottled lightning.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing.
It's the thing... As a writer, it's the funnest part of the day when you think of a solution to a problem, when you bust it. But the idea of doing that live on stage, that's bareback riding. It's so exciting.
It's very exciting. And when it works, it's amazing. And when it doesn't, it's awful.
Because there's no net. There's just the stage underneath.
And there's no hiding. You can't be like, God, thank God no one heard me make that joke. Because that was awful. They heard it. They looked at you. Your team players are looking at you like, wow, you made that joke.
And you better own it.
You're like, yep, I made that joke. Please say something else. And they rescue you. Like, we use that phrase a lot. Rescue people from scenes. Get them out of the scenes. Edit the scene because it hasn't worked. But doesn't matter. We've got another scene. Who cares? Yeah. So it's very positive because you're always looking for the next thing and you're always thinking, well, we can fix the story. One of my teachers, David Shaw, used to say, it's never too late to save your show. It's never too late to fuck your show. And if you think about that in writing as well, like if you're just sitting down going, even if we are on the 11th draft of this, we could save this.
Yeah.
Isn't that great? Like maybe today's the day.
The energy that comes off that is unbeatable and uncapturable normally, and is the thing you're always looking for.
And
the way you're describing this is so exciting because this is why you do it.
Whether
you're a writer or a performer or employee, you're after that moment of absolute magic where a second ago it was broken and now it's fixed. That's what everyone's looking for, and that's brilliant. I'd never occurred to me that was what I was watching in Who's Iron and what I'm watching when I'm watching improv.
Thank fuck somebody filmed all that improv for us, you know?
To make us understand what it is.
Put it on TV on a Friday night at a point at which we could all sit and enjoy it.
And now you can, if there isn't a lot of filmed improv, and now you can watch it and technically unpick it if you want. It's all on 4AD, the entire Who's Line series.
God, and there's about 130 episodes.
There's like nine series, and like it is a lot. Yeah, but dip in.
You'll learn.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Carrie, my brain is absolutely full. That was a spectacular conversation.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on Rule of Three.
Thank you.